Alright, it's nice to be here. I don't live this far away. I live in Port Melbourne, so it's nice to do a lot of this talk. I'm going to talk a bit today about probably how I got involved in the comic book story and how I was involved in writing books and more the people about behind the story, I suppose. I didn't ever train with a historian or a writer. And so fell into it by mistake. I always did social market research, and still do. But when I write books as a passion on the side, I suppose, and I find topics too interesting. And the Cobbling Co. one was a story I fell across when I was a young kid, going out to the Fiscal Hall as a fan of French property. And this is an old Cobbling Co. station, I'll show you bits of it in there. He described his great grandmother as run Cobbling Co. in the 89. We'll talk a bit then, let's see. If you've got questions for me, don't forget, then let me know. We can just take it nice and interactive and chat along the way. I'll show you some pictures and talk mostly. So the first thing some of you might remember was a show on telly called Whiplash. That's in the 60s. 67 or something? I was only born in 67. Wow. Yeah. As you might remember, it was a bit of a Wild West type looking type thing. The Americans made a show for this growing market, did we really have a Wild West in Australia? But in fact we did, and I'll show you some pictures to prove it in a minute, that many of the towns around country Victoria were like the Wild West back then, and the way we lived wasn't too far off what some of the Hollywood pictures show. But before we do that, this is that hometown I used to go to when I was a youngster, out in the central west New South Wales. It was a dark, sad place when I was young. It was closed up, most of it closed up, with a few rooms open where this old couple, my godfather's parents, lived there. It was a house that was full of sadness and secrets. And I've always wondered why most of it had been closed up, because it had once been a very grand home with 10 bedrooms, and you'll meet some of the family members in a second. And then about 10 years ago, this mate of mine said to me, "Oh, look, we've got these old letters from my great-grandmother who locked in the family safe." And we agreed with the Dell partners who had common code 100 years ago that we wouldn't ever share this letter for years. But I want you to read these now, and look at them. And I started looking at these old letters, which were written, in pretty shocking handwriting. But suddenly, and they were written by this woman, Bella Whitney, who will see pictures of in a second, to her counterpart, Ada Rumsfeld, who was the other partner's wife in the comic book room. And they were really about their husbands and about the business and about their families and about the angst of being a very powerful family with lots of money and how to control their husbands, who were at the time quite mad, and you'll learn about that in a minute. And it spurred my interest in writing a book about this girl, because I thought, well, she's amazing, this woman. How could she have taken on control of this huge sort of enterprise? And suddenly sort of the families and the story started to come to life for me a bit more, and I started to think, well, maybe there was a premise. It was just this woman, I think, Bella Whitney there on the left, and her counterpart Ada Rutherford on the right, who were both married to the main partners in Cobb & Co., who bought it from Watson and Co. Down here in Melbourne in the 1860s. Bella Whitney had 10 kids, but she did back then, she had a bit of money. Her husband there was one of the original partners in the firm. And they lived out on the frontier of film, I suppose, light and sticks, because they were breeding horses for Cobb & Co. coaches on properties up in the Macquarie Marshes in northwestern New South Wales for many years. And they had their first kids up there, but they, as happened those days, often the kids died young, and sure enough, the first one of the kids died quite
early on when another one died a few years later. After he was only about 6 months old, and his brother died 9 months after that. And then Frank Whitney finally died, but he was one of the main partners of the firm in 1894. And Bell was left to sort of hold the reins of the company with the partner, who we'll meet in a second. And she was a strong woman, really strong woman. But she was ashamed by her son. Her eldest son, after her husband died, she sent to a mental asylum because she thought he was mentally too weak to run a couple like Cobb and Co. And he was put a mental asylum in hospital in Sydney, and he lived there for the next 40 years before he died. That left her with one son left and four daughters, and another daughter died of heart attacks, killed by a dog on the property. She was probably a beautiful girl, but she died young too. And then the other son was left, he was banished to an neighbouring property because Bella wanted control of the Coventry Empire, and so she sent her other son away to one of the other property family had. And so she was left with herself and four daughters in the house. And it was all sort of wooden roots, supposed to be like this place, and she made sure her daughters were married doctors and got themselves up to society. So back in those days, it's all about getting a place in society that's higher than where we were now. Yeah, that was the house they lived in. That house was built in 1900. So it was built, they lived in that from 1900 on.
It looks on the
paper, the way it was splendid, yes. And it was built with Cobb & Co. money, because they'd made a fortune out of Cobb & Co. So they built, once her husband died in 1894, she got the best architects she could find, she built this enormous house for her daughters and herself to live in, the four of them. And she lived there, Bella Whitney, until she died as a 97-year-old, in 1941. So, that was... I had pictures of people, and these are some of the people we met later, these are the partners of the firm. And so I wanted to try and get to know these people, who they were and what it was like to run a company back then. And the main guy that saw it all took place was James Rutherford. He was one of the other guys who bought this company from Watson & Co. And he was a pleasant character. As you can see, he was a pretty young, dashing guy, taken to Melbourne in the late 1850s, maybe 1861, when he just bought Cobb & Co. And he had incredible drive. He also had a very, he had an illness that he was desperate to keep from the rest of the company in the rest of Australia. And we'll talk more about that in a minute, because it affected the whole company. The first book I wrote was called Partner's Wife. That was about this woman and her place in the comic book story. I took that to an agent and they liked it, and then a publisher called Penguin said, yeah, we like it too. Then people read it again and said, oh, hang on, we'll sell more copies of this book if you rewrite it as non-fiction. Because all I've done is I've actually fictionalised this, but this was a story I didn't know well enough, I sort of made things up. And they said, why don't you go back to the see if you can find out some of the real, some more of the details, some more of the real story, because it is some more books, it's a true story. And so I groaned and rolled my eyes and thought, oh God, but I did. And it was quite fun to put into the deeper. And the true story, when I found it, was more extraordinary than the stuff I'd made up. It was amazing. It was quite artistic of today. But it involved us both with three guys particularly, who were the key partners in Cobb & Co. After they bought it. We'll talk about them in a second. And still Bella Whitney, of course, took over when her husband died. I had some questions I had to answer as a researcher, as a historian. What happened was this girl, Morgan Bill, he wants to husband die, she challenges his will. Because his will tells her that she's got to sell her share of Cobb & Co. At the time that he died, Australia was in an enormous drought from the depression in the 1890s. And Cobb & Co. was worth nothing. And she decided, if I stop now, I'm going to lose everything for my bills that I've been working for decades. But she refused. And she took his will to court. And she got a private member's bill passed in Parliament. In New South Wales, so she could ignore his will. Then she takes a visit to James Rutherford Court in 1900 as well, and I thought, why is she doing this? You know, she's got a dentist. So that was an interesting part of the story for me to understand. Then I see the letter that she saw earlier, which says this guy Rutherford is mentally unhinged and mad. He is mad. How can he run the nation's largest business in the 1800s, which had sort of staff and horses and stables all over Australia? then there's Paul, the Paul guy, who's the other sort of style partner in the business. How did he become one of those richest men?
And it wasn't a common guy. We'll find out how it was in a minute. Some of you might know. Because, of course, he and his wife established the Waterman Alliance of Hall Trust.
After his death in 1911. That was Walter Hall.
So he's a business partner of Robinson. Okay? Man in the middle of Robinson. Yeah, that's Robinson.
Yeah, James Robinson. Alright. When you're writing books, you've got to see if anyone else has done the book you want to do already, and there will be a few books to come out. Will Lawson wrote a book in the 1930s called When Cobb and Co was King, fictionalised account, romanticised of Cobb and Co and what it might have been like to ride and coach back then. But Donald Tim Austin here in Melbourne wrote a book in 1967, which was a really dry account of Cobb and Co, but it told lots of good details. But he'd gone to Mrs. Rutherford, one of the tenants, and said, can you help me with the book? She refused. She's writing her own book and she didn't want to help him. She's merely giving any of the dirt she had on her own family. And she wanted to protect the family too. She didn't want all the truth to come out because there was lots of, well, mental illness we're going to talk about today, but in her family she didn't want it revealed. So she brought her own self-published book out in 1971, for Cobblico, which was pretty crappy, but she did it. Then a few books came out in the 90s and about 2003. I'm just from Roots, Roots in New South Wales and Roots in Queensland. So, comes down to where the Roots ran, where the Shane Stashes were, and a bit about the coats and stuff. There was nothing really on the families and the people behind the business. So for me that was terrific. The trouble for me was, it was a story that I had to span a large number of decades. The tour in Gold Rush down here, where it was started, in the 1850s of course, with Freeman Cobb and Watson, and then I had to go through the 1860s with Gold Rush in South Wales. And then I had to sort of keep the reader engaged from the railway boom that was out in the 70s and the forget traditions they had in Melbourne and Sydney where they carried all these people down by coach and train to the coast to see these amazing displays from around the world. So the 1880s where we had this land and inland pasture boom, the whole inland Australia was open up with big properties, I suppose, and we were sort of riding on the ship's back, so to speak. Then the 1890s where they had that drought that took that fall and financial market collapses and shearer strikes and nationalism, and I had to try and wrap it up by about the turn of the century where, you know, the Federation voted in the women. So it was a large amount of time to go through. What I quickly discovered was probably there wasn't just a firm carrying people. They were the Qantas of their day, you know, they carried people, but they were also the TNT that actually carried tons of parcels around the country. They were working at a time before we had a national postal service, so they were all from Australia Post because they were contracted by the government to carry all the mail. So it was the route they ran. So it was really important. People got excited about Cobb and Co's purchases arriving in town because that was their one communication with the outside world before we had the telegraph and telephones and those sorts of things. They were also the holding of the day because they had an enormous coach building factories around Australia which built coaches not only for their own use but also for private individuals who wanted a little budget to take a kid's school on or a fancy coach to go searching. And we'll look at some pictures of those in a minute. They were a huge pastoral firm and since they had very large sheep and cattle and horse breeding stations around the country. Enormous interest for them to look at too, because they decided it was better to breed their own horses than buy them in. They needed tons of horses and people seeing a step. Of course the story starts though with this guy Freeman Cobb, who came over here in 1864 or so, with his boss from California. His boss took one look at the state of the roads down around Port Melbourne and it was such a swamp down there. And you couldn't get, in the wet season, you just couldn't, things wouldn't move. Coaches of bob trying to move all the goods up from the bay up into town. And they were turning their hair out and said, look, we can't keep going here. After a month or two of trying, this boss said, we're going home. We can't go on a coach business in a colony just off the over the roads. So he went home. Young Freeman though, 23, said, I haven't learned that it's down that he goes. He got together three of the other coach drivers in to come out with the coaches for this firm and said, why don't you stay with me and we'll go on for them together? And they did four of them, four young guys in their early 20s. And this guy was remarkable. He was very good at organising things and he had
a big advantage. We had this coach who's brought out from the US, which are something called a Concord coach, which meant they were, we'll see a picture in a minute of them, but they were strung on a little leather thoroughbreds, far from high. So they had some suggestion on them. And I made a picture instead of the English coaches we had there at the moment in Australia were made of much heavier wood that would crack under that was going to feed. So the American coaches were lighter and they could travel fast without falling apart. And Freeman decided, well, if I could make my coach go twice as fast as the opposition coach, people would all come with me, because people were greedy back then to go to the gold field quickly and come back quickly. People had this mania for, you know, finding gold. And sure enough, he did so. He said to himself, I've got to make the horses gallop that often when they get fast. They can't gallop the whole way from Melbourne to Bendigo. I'll have change stations every 10 miles. And every 10 miles, I'll change the horses, and I'll fresh their horses, so they can gallop, type thing. It meant that he had to have tons and tons of saddle air, horse and bridles, and he had to groom for the train station. So logistically, it was a nightmare. But it was incredibly successful, and people had a lot of money. People would pay, you know, 6, 7, 8 weeks' wages. Sometimes for some workers, it was sort of 6 months' wages to travel by the coach to get the gold. And they'd sell up all their own to get out there, in the hope that they would find a gold thing that would make them happy and rich. We were all so good after, because what you do out of town, you have all these horses for pure bays, or they're all sort of all white. And so coming out of town altogether, the six were however terrific. And they'd buy a vehicle when they'd come into a town, to announce the mail was here. And it was a real sort of sight for people to get excited about. That was one of his partners, Peck, just started a business here called Peck and Stone from. And that's two of the other guys. Now, I think this is Watson. That might be Watson there, I think that might be Watson who's made the coach there. After they bought the firm from Freeman Cobb. A lot of what's happened was these guys bought the firm for a ridiculous sum. Freeman and his mates only stayed with the business for 3.5 years. And they sold it for £16,000, which was an enormous sum back then. Freeman went back to the US and became senator, and then he decided to go over to South Africa, stop paying for things in South Africa for the diamond mines. And it was a little disaster because he worked and he died over there. But it's funny because the Cobb & Co. name stayed with the business even though the guy was only here for 3 years. And only running it for that very short time before he sold it to Watson and Co. Watson couldn't make a buck out of it. He couldn't pay his debt off, really. He had so much money for it, he just couldn't find out how he was going to pay it off. And so he had to answer quite quickly to some other blokes. Some of which were the guys we met before, Rutherford and Whitney and Hall and 7 other guys in a consortium of 10. They were successful because they had 10 of them to share the burden of the property. And so they were able to sort of pay back the huge amount quicker than these guys. Of course, the early routes went off to Bendigo and Ballarat and Geelong up to Ballarat and so forth. To the goldfield, of course, but one of the things about Victoria was, as I said before, there weren't much in the way of roads. You know, you were travelling through pretty dense bush a lot of the time, and it's terrifying thing for passengers. Drivers back then were pretty gung-ho. If you're going to be a good driver, you have to be what I call a talk show host of the day. You have to be able to tell yarns, and then just home to because people were riding in your coaches for sometimes days on end to go somewhere, especially if it's not a long distance. And so they wanted to be entertained, and a good driver who's got the same business is someone who channeled the yarns. But they were often pretty rough and ready. If there were bushfires, the drivers tended to just try and walk the horses through it, rather than sort of go skirt around. The passengers were terrified. They didn't hang on for dear life. And the coach would just smoke around, they couldn't see anything where they were going, and walk to see where they were going. But no one else did. And they'd be sort of galloping along with the smoke stirring here and there, hoping nothing would catch a light. So it was quite terrifying passengers off on these roads.
Were they still trading under the name Cobb?
They were, and you remind me of a physical issue. Because what happened was, that lots of other people would buy, Cobb & Co. might sell some routes, and say, we're scheduled, but now someone else can buy them from us. Another operator would run the routes, they would also call them Cobb & Co. though. In the end, what happened was Cobb & Co. became the generic name for any coach service around Australia. I'm going to talk today more about the main Cobbing Coast started when this business was started and the people who bought it off him. But there were other Cobbing Coasts in New Zealand and in South Australia and WA that had coached and called themselves Cobbing Coasts. Everybody knew that name.
Mm.
Yeah, and back then we didn't have something called or brand equity or something. You didn't have rights to names back then. Someone could use a name and you couldn't just, no one thought to me. I wasn't having to worry about that.
So
I asked a question of this one. Labasha. I was told that
the people who
owned Labasha.
Yes.
What is it? The house was owned by Robertson. Robertson and Labasha were two of their partners in Cobbing Coast business, and they were two Melbourne guys who stayed on and kept the Melbourne business going. Robertson had a gorgeous old house down here in Elsternwick somewhere called... It's open to the public this old. I went to look at the other day. It's National Trust. Gorgeous. I can't think now. I'm sure some of you have been there. Anyway, we'll talk about Robertson and Labasha in a minute, because they were the Melbourne guys who stayed on with the Melbourne connection and became rich.
Is that the typical,
going to bushland. Comico was running routes so well before we had made roads. So what would happen, just as the guy with S.T. Gill sketching in coach, S.T. Gill was an Englishman, he was quite a good sketcher, but he's sketching an English style coach. That's not what Freeman Cobb's coaches look like at all. That's what a coach might look like on an English road. English coaches were designed to go on a paved cobbled road. We didn't have any of those over here. We had dirt tracks and a bit of grass and so forth. So these weren't practical sort of sorts of coaches for here. But that's sort of a sketch out on road acid. This is a Wild West town, I thought it was anyway. It's actually a capital of Wallhalla.
Oh,
in rural Victoria. I've never been there, but it's all proud. Looks like a Hollywood strip. That shop there, but that's in Cobbing Coast Day, of course, in the 1890s, that shop taken. And it's a town and there's lots of mountains around it. It was one of the last places the Cobbing Coast ended up going out to, but it was sort of harder to get to, if you like.
Land was so limited there that people were
barely
standing up.
Really? Mm. Wow. So, of course, Cobbing Coast was servicing typical families like this, you know, people who are middle class, you know, miners, a long way from their families, and they were, you know, often waiting for letters or waiting for, you know, for loved ones to come and visit them. So it was a lonely distance down the frontier of, you know, Victoria back then, and so people loved having that Cobbing Coast contact. But it gave them the mail, it gave them their friends who came to visit them and so forth. So it was incredibly, I suppose, powerful brand, if you like, back then for people, because they had a connection for them, which helped them up with the day.
Yeah.
It employed, of course, not only drivers, but all kinds of blacksmiths and people to make the saddlery, and tons of office ancillary personnel who were doing a ton of different jobs to keep the whole business going. So it was a huge employer, you know, they had a little saddle factory up in Brisbane in the 1880s, making their saddles for them. What they had to do is change stations I talked about before, along the way, and this is just a sketch by a local newspaper reporter of a typical train station with a train purchase order. They're often run by a single bloke or maybe an Aboriginal guy and his wife, or it's a lonely distance out there, and these guys, the business partners who owned it, would have to go around and check on these guys to check they were slacking off. If they were asleep on the job or they were drinking, they'd get fired straight away. Because one thing about the Cobbing Coast guy, particularly James Glover, he had no tolerance for drinking. And there were some funny stories where drivers would, back then alcohol was a big problem in Australia as it is today. And you get drivers who had a big night before, they'd get up next morning to go and it would start at 5 a.m. and they'd be asleep on the coach by sort of, you know, an hour later. And a passenger would have to take over the because they'd say, you know, the owner found out they dismissed this kind of guy, but it was common practice back then for some guys, you know, to like a bottle of it. Yeah, we should talk about the bushland. It's a good point. The stories in the book I written are more about trying to hold up to New South Wales and Queensland. There weren't as many down here. But the Bushrangers had an interesting tactic. Probably how they had a company policy of not letting us drive to carry guns for their own safety. And the Bushrangers did this. So when they were held up, drivers would just stand back and just, you know, let the guys to the vehicle. The Bushrangers just wanted the vehicle. So they'd take everybody out of the coach, put all your stuff on the ground, all your jewellery and persons and so forth. And they'd pick through it. And they'd also be looking, of course, for the gold boxes. That's one of the other jobs of the coach company, was to carry the gold from the gold digging back into the major banks in these boxes. If you were clever, women in those days often had big hairdos, and if you were a clever woman, they actually populated with inside your hair. Because the Bushmen were quite frivolous guys, and they wouldn't actually touch a woman when they were sort of, you know, doing a hold-up. They'd make sure, you know, people would just have put stuff on the ground. So women knew this. So they knew they could put the jewelry up in their hairdo and no one would ever look at their hair. I'm quite clever at that. I probably at least should have worked that around. I think so, wouldn't they? But, I mean, they apparently they didn't want to get a reputation for rough handling women. So, they didn't do it. Anyway, you could also, some people used to hide the valuables in straw. The straw on the bottom of the coach to keep it fairly warm. They put the valuables in there so the guys can find them. And the coal miners had a very clever system of hiding the gold boxes. Often what used to happen is the gold would be accompanied by escorts, police escorts, to protect it. So what happened was, the Bushrangers were really good horsemen, and they could always out-ride the police escorts and overpower them. So it ended up being an advertisement for the Bushrangers that there was gold and that they could approach them and have escorts. So they decided to do away with the escorts and just hide the gold in certain places or switch it to another coach. Mm-hmm. Funny stories in the book about that kind of thing and how they had to get around that. But it was obviously part of the hazard of travel, that kind of thing. This coach here is just a good example of a typical size coach with six horses there in the main street of Melbourne here. And if you can see it look carefully, about half the passengers are actually sitting up on top of the coach. And in fact, all coaches were like that. All coaches had half the seats on top and half the seats inside. If you're a woman, you always had to sit inside. It wasn't the same thing as a woman sitting up on top. It was a bit rough though, because inside the coach, you're often there for a day or two on end if you're on a long trip. Even if it was 4 hours, it was hard. Because these were the days before we had much of the way to go, but people didn't shower very often back then. And so you pretty smelly. And English ladies were often quite horrified that to sit in a coach with strangers, they didn't know, for hours and hours on end, when they were used to having their own personal coach back home perhaps. So it was quite rough on some of these women. You'll see a few letters in a second from some of the women who were travelling on these coaches about what it's like. The best seat was next to the driver here called the box seat. He had the one set of coaches with a paddock at his own. Because, you know, the driver had a paddock for his, but the rest of the seats were just a bear for the board thing. The trouble was that you had to pay full money for it, and you had to actually get down and open the gates on the road, and you also had to operate the brake on that side of the vehicle to drive. So you had to work it quite hard. And so if you look carefully, all the photos you see today, everybody's wearing a hat. You've been dead in a country of Australia, not just Australia, without a hat on. Anybody over the age of five, people wear a hat everywhere. You'll see the style of hats change over time, but they're all wearing them.
That's
a picture of a hat. Yeah, that's got about 8 on top and 8 inside, 16 people in that one. The coaches will feed today carried anything from 4 people up to 80 people. I think the next coach we're going to look at, this one here, you can see the horses, if you count along here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, there's 6 pairs of horses there, that's 12 horses pulling at the northern coach. You can't see the coach itself very well in the shop, you can see it on the next stop a bit better. It was an extraordinary coach called the Leviathan, built by some miners, just got a week from Bendigo. Forgetting of course they didn't have a coach company monthly, anyway, so they built it with the money they made and sold the Cobblecoat bought it as a novelty. And it could carry sort of 70, 80 passengers. People lost their side of it off the Campbell and side end up carrying from 90. It was so heavy though that could only rattle on flat roofs without hills and things. It was made famous by being the first coach to carry the in what's called the Super Tenders of Australia, for the MCG, in 1862 or so. It did get me down the horse cure though, because the horses were often so exhausted after pulling it on the strip, they fall over, some of them fall over and cut. So it wasn't a, it was a small jig in a sense, and after 3 or 4 years it was thrown away with, because it was just intractable and couldn't reach the speed that common dogs and stuff had with that, because it was such a heavy thing. The other problem with it was, if you're a driver, you've got to be able to tell your lead horses which way to turn left or right. And usually you do that with your whip. And you'd actually, you'd turn on the ear, the left horse or the right horse. The problem with this person was, I want the whip long enough to reach that far up. So they had a problem. There was one driver here in Melbourne called Ned Devine, who was an amazing driver and had a fortune the same as the firm. He didn't have much an answer to this. He carried a pocket full of pebbles, and he had a good shot. And he could throw a pebble at the lead horse and hit it on the ear, on the left or the right, if you wanted to turn. The people would come to you and start to see the thing, unbelievable. I suspect the horses actually knew where they were going to go anyway. But Ned Devine was paid a lot of money by the firm to, ride this particular coach for 2 years. It actually ran on the Geelong to Ballarat route for some years, that one. A picture of it. There's an artist impression of it. Going from Ballarat to Geelong there. As you can see, the people on top of all look pretty fancy and swing up straight. It was actually a bit more chaotic than that. But that's sort of what was, it's supposed to look like in theory. I mean, as you can see here, they've got all the horses are all sort of black, I think people are dark. And they sort of have plumes on them, they sort of dress them all up. It's quite a fancy outfit. What we might do, this is an interesting stop here. This is a perfect example of a Concord coach with a rounded bottom. You see here with a leather fireplace underneath. And you can see all the people on top here. This is unusual because it's actually carrying Chinamen. The Chinamen were known, famous for walking in the gold field, but Tom Daly travelled by coach. You can see all their hats and sorts of lashed to the back of the coach here. This is where you put all your legs, you lash it on the back here, or up on top of you, sit on top of it just about. But you can see it looks sort of precarious up there. And some of these coaches were loaded very high up, but they had an amazingly central speed centre of gravity. They just seem to sit. I think. You're allowed to carry, as soon as you have a luggage allowance on a coach, which is that same allowance you have on an aeroplane now in the cabin. You have that small bag you can carry into a plane with you, it's about as much as you're allowed to carry on the coach, unless you pay extra, on the coach here. What they do is they put a tarp on over the back of the coach to protect the luggage zipper. I think there's another shop there, yeah, the tarp there over the luggage, but things will get pretty wet and damaged all the time. As you can see, they stack up quite high on the load on the top there. If you're a travelling salesman, you use coaches quite a lot to carry the goods around. You might have a whole basket of goods you want to sell to the property owners. And they stack more up high like that and pay extra for that. Sort of pleasure. What happened in Troy though, probably didn't last nearly as long here as it lasted in another 4 weeks, because of the railway network. This map shows the railway expanding every 10 years. Mm-hmm. And as you can see in Victoria, they had an astounding amount of railway, which grew up because it was so rich out of gold, Victoria was very well concerning. They put the railway through wherever they could in Victoria, and whenever the railway went in, it made a coach route redundant. The railways were much more comfortable, faster and cheaper than coach travel. So by 1900, there was not one more coach route left in Victoria. The owners, relatively his mates, could see the writing on the wall with this, and they quickly moved the business up. Well, expand the business out of Bendigo up near New South Wales in about 1863, because there was a dollar rush happening up in New South Wales at the time. And so they said, okay, we'll leave Watson and Regner to run the Victorian business, which they did very well, and we'll go and, branch out into Queensland and New South Wales. And they set off from this hotel for the Albion. Shamrock. 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 Shamrock.
still there, actually.
Yeah.
Let's go up there with some tin caches. There's the three black pans here, and headed north. What they've done is we're about to marry the two partners. There's our friend Bella Whitney there in Adelaide. They were both publican stores. And it wasn't probably unsurprising that these guys were both in our publican stores. They were so busy on the road, they didn't get time to do anything except meet the girl for a pub with a steak night. So they'd had their horses all stabled at the hotel, like the Shamrock, and they'd followed them to meet. The only girls in the pub in those days were sort of in the publican stores. These two were. They were fairly sort of middle class occupation. These girls quickly became very wealthy through their husbands, and became great friends. So in the world, they quickly split up to a headquarters in Bathurst, put one in apartments in Sydney, one in Melbourne, Orange, because that's where all the gold fields were out here, and they needed to win a mail contract in Sydney, so they needed someone there to get the mail contracts. So what was all with there? What we'll talk about now for a second, I'll more about what's like to travel on the coast. Because I thought that was a bit of fun. Back in 1982, you might get a guide and timetables of where you could, what time the coach left to go somewhere. If you're travelling sort of overnight, you stay out on the Barkingstead hotels all the way up, and this is one in Castle Cobar, New South Wales, which was owned by a mining company that town back then. These are nice towns, of course, but it was pretty rough and ready. You'd bring your own flag if you could, because you were just given a sort of a patch of earth with a sacking on it, and there was sort of a bare room with a kitchen stacking between the winner and the men's room. You'd eat in your meal, which was included in your ticket fare, in the pub next door. Probably could serve you up something. You should maybe pour venison or lamb, but you should go. It's got cheap and sort of up. And people didn't know any difference in casserole. And you'd pay extra for your drinks. And they try and keep your drinks there as long as they're good, because they make good money out of drinks, of course. Just like they do these things.
It was
pretty sort of frontier. There's a funny story in the book there about a governess who's going out. If you look further further out, they didn't even have pubs like this. And so Commonwealth negotiated with station owners to have their travellers set up in the station owner's property or in their sort of house. And this girl's horrified to find she had to share a bed with the three station owners' daughters, squeezed into one bed together. And she was sort of pissed off that was sort of what she was getting for her maid, with a bed to share with three girls. But most people didn't complain much at all, and you'll see some pictures in a second of some of the hardships. One of the problems, of course, was accident for the coach and the horse scooped. It was a terrifying experience if you're coming down a steep road, a steep mountain, and the turn the road. The turn, you have to make sure or any steep road coming down, the horse is always walking, of course, so you don't have to go control. If the horses are galloping, what could happen, of course, once you turn around, if you know physics at all, the horses can pull the coach that way. The way that the coach can pull the coach in the direction of where we're going, over the ravine. And that's what would happen if your horses could spook and gallop. So what the drivers would do is, at the top of the hill, they'd lash a small sapling in the back of the coach, of a massive drag, to remind the horses to walk and go slowly coming down. If the brakes were strong enough, you know, on a steep hill. Some of the drivers got cocky though, and you know, oh, I can't find a fucking delay or I'm too late again. And there was a nasty accident that would happen if your horse did foot coming down the hill and weren't walking. So, just be careful. They travel, of course, up in the snow now, got two, and bring your own rugs for that kind of trip if you're travelling up through the snow. And often they were travelling over rivers. Before we had made roads and made bridges, probably because I was opening up Australia, so there was usually not a nice bridge to go over. And if the water level was low enough, of course, if you walk the coach through like that, and you just get your feet wet and those kinds of days, but you could get through. Often, of course, though, especially with the bigger rivers from Queensland and New South Wales, it was too deep, and you had to use a barge to float the coach over. And if you look carefully at this spot, you can actually see the coach and the passengers putting the coach on the barge here. You come off the end of some part of the river, pulling the coach over with a rope, sorry, barge over with a rope. The horses are actually getting the water swimming along the side. sort of with their sort of reins attached to the barge here. So it was a bit of a sort of a make-do arrangement, but it could have worked. Keeping the barge there.
On the coast, off from Queensland, you've got a bit of crocodile in the
Yes, right off the Dyke Common Carrier. Yeah. Well, since the roof, the picture of the roof in the second, but they had an enormous network going right up the top. They tended not to try and drive in the wet season up there, because it was just impossible in the wet season. Often there wasn't actually a barge there, because the days were all up, I think, a barge there. And so what would happen then, if the river was so deep, or the rain come and the river was swollen, is everybody would get out, then the swim over, the coach would be pulled over the bottom with a rope, the wood would be floated over in a tub, and the women would be floated over in a tub. And there's a funny story in the book about this governance I've talking about before, who has this experience. The trouble was, this all happened in the middle of the night, and before in the rain. And she gets out the throw of the river, she's all over the bathtub, and the driver says, well, you can't get back in the coach yet because the road's too boggy. You're going to have to walk on the side of the coach to get in that bog. So the passengers, this wasn't unusual, the passengers have to walk along the side of the coach for the next 2 hours, as the horses walk slowly, talk amongst themselves as if normal thing they do every day. And it's amazing how little people complain. The next time you're learning about the traffic, think about these people and what they've been up to back then, because it wasn't all easy travelling. If you were travelling up in Queensland, a lot of people took black squirrel planes, and Cooper's were renowned for bogging in those planes if it was a bit wet. And just have a picture of one that's done by a force. Hopefully you could dig it out. If you couldn't dig it out, what had to happen, if Orbico had the mail contracts for that route, because they had a contract with the government to get the mail to the next town 5-7 times, and the passengers would use it, they had to unhitch the horses from the coach, and the driver would carry on the axle end of the mail bag over his shoulder, waiting for the next town for mail, leaving the passengers in the coach to fend for themselves for a day or so, so help came along. Sometimes you get something worth cooking, and they light a fire, and you could help your yards, and they'd get rescued in those days, but the coach back picked them up. But people knew that the mail always depended on the passengers back then, because it was the only communication they had with the outside world, from the town. Their businesses was this common co-coach. So it was, again, it was sort of a way of life that you wouldn't want to be in a rush to get somewhere if you're travelling a long distance, and often you were delayed by days at a time. So I was not quite good at fixing a broken wheel on the fly. They could, you know, get a bit of tree trunk from the other tree and sort of, you know, hold something together to fix the wheel rather than having to, you know, call up for repairs. That might do that phone call. So people were very good at doing that. Once the commentator tried changing over to motor vehicle, which we'll look at it later, they had problems with fixing them on the fly. It wasn't easy. Well, that's just one of our bold places again. And if you get very nasty, horses can break their legs and all kinds of things. It was a real pain in the arse. So, why is that one blank? Oh, the cheaper of fun letter from a lady that you go from a city to a place called Burke in far western New South Wales. She's writing to her friend, talking about the trip. I was very frightened that after the coach turned over half into a creek, the horse jumped out into the water halfway up to her knees, landing heavily all day. Came off for the long way to the dog. But we walked 5 miles through mud and water, like a swimming back port. When we were within 3 miles of our destination from up the front of the Auckland and Regana, sitting as horse on the court, the fat woman and the baby in front of me, all the things were taken out, and now the people stage out the wheels out. We wanted to pull the coach out backwards. But we also knew that it hurt. The next mile, John and Manning were walking in front of the coach to find the road. We reached the destination at 10 p.m. with our clothes nearly knee deep in mud. So you can see from her letter to her friend, just the kind of thing you had to put up with it as a punter on a coach back then. It reminds me though that of course these coaches are travelling often at night, and if there's no moon up, you can't see the road. Because a driver would have to go ahead off and pick the road out and let the horses see the route really well. If you have a fresh set of horses who aren't so got in other areas of the road, you might get a man walking in front to see it out. Because all you had to deal, there were little blacks on the coach, little blacks went about 3 feet of light, not far at all the things where the lamp light would go, but they were very good. So mostly they travel by moonlight, that's good. And the reason for they were traveling at night was to begin to make those mail contracts, to make sure they could get the mail there next day. So there was no sort of, you know, having big breaks. There's the routes to Comico Mountain, New South Wales and AM3. As you can see, they're quite extensive. Going, you know, right up the border there, there's sort of
centered around birth and exactly birth and all places. You might see though, the strange thing about the mountains, there's no roots going out to the coast. Does anyone know why?
Railways?
The railways, exactly. Yes. By this stage, only three little railways connecting up Sydney with Musselbrook, Worth Victor, Middle Great Northern Line, and the Great Southern one coming down here through Goulburn. So there's one coming out here to Bathurst. And of course, probably they had to always cross through the railways to make sure they fed into the railway routes. So they were, once the railway was up, they could already learn that they were redundant, but they had to make sure their routes all fed into where the railway stopped. And by 1820, the railways only went to Orange, in this case out the west of it. And they always have to make sure, once the railway opened up on the new part of the district, they'd have to close the route down and move them all somewhere else. So they never bought premises, they always went. And they shift all their staff and horses and coaches, you know, to the next part of Australia, because further out again. Meanwhile, there's another route, which is now called the Commonwealth Highway, running up from Zilpa and up through Hay and Wilcannia, up through some Broken Hill and Tumabala there. The main guys we met before, Walker, Paul and Rutherford, and Whitney, didn't have any time for this route, but the guy in Victoria said, I will run this route, we'll take this one on. And they did so, it made them a fortune, because of what happened in the 1880s onwards, when the gold was running out here, probably people were trying to use mineral deposits around Broken Hill and other areas around here, and there were tons of prospectors coming out this way to make themselves rich. The trouble with these guys was, there were no natural water courses out here, big rivers. You didn't try and quickly cut through along a river or a creek, so you could water your horses along the way. They didn't have much to go here, this was pretty dry country. You had to be innovative if you were a coach owner, and these guys were clever. What they did, of course, I don't know what they did. Well, they used hammers in dry season to pull the coaches instead, because camels didn't need much water, of course. So it was a clever way of getting around it. Not so comfortable trip for the passengers, but camels don't have a very comfortable hamper. But it was practical enough, and it did for the roots at the time, particularly in the dry season when there wasn't any water for the horses. But it reminded me how innovative you've got to be as an owner back then, particularly, and think your way around problems. Commonwealth didn't need to advertise much. All they put in the paper was where their roots ran from and to and what time of day they left. They were a staple like bread or butter was. You know, it wasn't something you had to be too fussy about in later years. Everybody took it for granted as you covered. There's the route they had in Queensland at that same time, and they advised everyone to go well up to the Gulf Cup interior up in Normanton there. So some enormous routes. They weren't the only operator in any of these holdings we're looking at. There were lots of other companies doing coaching too, but they had the lion's share, so certainly in Queensland for many years. And again, they had feeder council, had a railway coming in here, connecting that up. So the railway from Rockhampton, connecting up these places. So they were also feeding from railways there. And the shareholder changed to get up in Queensland, I believe they were running from Hallmates to join the business up in that part of the country. It led by the 1870, you could probably touch it if you really wanted to, all the way from the Central Gulf down in South Australia, up through Victoria, and into the Queensland, to the Gulf, Carpentaria there. You'd never do it, it would take you sort of months and then you'd have lots of goods by the time you got there. It was much quicker if you needed to have a decent distance to travel by steamer. And people did say it was cheaper to travel by steamer. So if you had to go, say, from Melbourne up to, say, Longreach, you'd actually take a steamer up the coast as far as the Cook, maybe to Rockhampton, then get the train in again, when the train line ran out, you transfer over the coast. It was just a much more comfortable way of traveling and much quicker those days, you know, roads were pretty soften. So the coach business was really just for people in the inland. So they need to travel around the inland. So it was mostly a pastoral community, I suppose. This is just a reminder that we talked about the fact that we're soften for the creeks. This is just an old map of the coach route, and you'll see some creeks there, where the route goes and where the railway. So these days you never see much the old coach route, because the main road we build these days, sitting on higher land, which won't flood, point, the coach would tend to snake around the bit so they could keep the horses warm.
They tend to be on the sack roads a bit. I was going to tell you, show you a few of the pictures of the vehicles these guys made.
This is just one of those little buggies you can take as kids to school with. The buckle might take kids to the school there. On one of these things, the kids will sit 5 pedal on it. Or you might just buy it from the factory, one of these buckle buggies to take shopping in. It's got a flat bed here. You can use it to take the shopping home a few miles back to your house. In the days before they had trolley cars and taxis and things. That was a pretty simple, cheap sort of vehicle. But compared to how many you buy one of these hoaches, even the innovative design having a sun hood on the top there, the drivers all started to get headaches from the sun. I wonder why it's putting a sunstroke up in the north particularly. They were always painted red and yellow, the coaches and things got glass. If you're a fancy family, you could buy one of these fancy coaches, and put some leather and glass windows in if you really wanted to. Impress your neighbours when you go to church, or just something to go around the property in, or go and visit the neighbours in. The other thing we were talking about a bit earlier, the fact they had a huge property empire, and in fact they had property stations, one called Miranda Downs up in the South Carlton area, and they had one called, in this area here in the Rivers Country, also Jarvis here in the Rivers, it's been found recently. They had a huge property called Davenport Downs, they had some a big one called Cunnamulla, before the town of Cunnamulla came into being, and they had to run right down the border here in Victoria to see the Suka. There's a lot of them over here. They've got a huge empire. They can actually shift their cattle or horses or sheep to different parts of Australia, depending on where the drought was worse, I suppose. And of course, they'd walk them into the market to the coast, often through the day before we had road trains. There's some amazing stories in the book from young boys who worked the cobbling hoe with their drivers and the cattle hands who were out there sort of for weeks on end sort of driving cattle. One guy who and Holt and he liked verbal letters to the parents about these his time up there. Amazing. By adding family these partners have become so wealthy, they've got this sort of grand houses and Karen's mother built an amazing house out of Bathurst with a port of marble, and he wasn't home very much. He was such a workaholic and a manic personality, he was always on the road. So his 9, 10, 11 kids never saw him much. They had servants at home there to look after them all, and they had all the wanted to jump to mummy and dad, but he was too much a dad. This is Walter Hall, and he built a large mansion called Wildfell in Potts Point in Sydney, down the water. Oh, we were going to find out how Walter made his money. He became Comico's private banker, in a way, really, because Comico was always going to banks for money, saying, we want to buy another property, we want to buy more stations, more purchases, and banks would often say, look, you've already bought this, but you can't anymore. And that was Dan's only one, that he was this mad guy who couldn't stop shopping, buying things. His mate was made a fortune, because what had happened, he had a brother working up in Queensland on a mine, as a manager, for the three-out boys called Ted and Tom and Fred Morgan. Anyway, Brother said, oh look, I think that's the money's made. If these Morgan boys want to sell out, why don't you come in, just come in with me and buy it, and I think it's still sold on the ground there. And Walter said, yeah, I'll go in, I'll put the money in, and he contacted his business partner, said, why don't we all go together? The other two said, no, we've got too much place tied up already, we're not doing it. He still went ahead. He took about £50,000 out of the business and put it in this Mount Morgan place, and for about 2 years, Mount Morgan had become Australia's richest gold mine. And made him and his wife a fortune. His wife wasn't able to have children, so when he died, she was left to refuse amount of money, and she gave £1 million to Commonwealth to split up between the three eastern states, mental education and medical research. And at the time, it was the biggest request anyone had ever given to a government. but perhaps it was non-commissioned, wasn't able to have kids. The sad thing was, when I went up to Mount Morgan to look at the beach there, it's just one of the poorest, saddest towns in Australia I've ever seen. The biggest part of Mount Morgan now is the graves. There's a huge cemetery of 15 miles where all people who were mining in the area died, which is enough to actually mine back then. It was a dangerous occupation for mining. And it's now here, one of the poorest parts of Australia. No one can work at there anymore for mines to be mined out, and it's some longer dust now, really. So there's a suburb, Mount Morgan, once they did get their suburbs. And one of the suburbs is called Walker Hall. Still after this man, he was seen as a kindly grandfather of the town, and he sort of put lots of money into it back at the time. But he was sort of, I suppose, the unknown, I suppose, money behind the Cobbin Code, allowed it to keep going. Our other partner, Walker, well, Frank William, he bought a house called Fleming Park at Bud Bathurst, which was a beautiful old house, and he and the wife just moved there before he died, and that was nice. What was happening though, the Cobbin Code, they were finding there weren't any money out of mail anymore. That blue total is the total amount of money pounds made out of mail contracts for the whole state of New South Wales. And the Cobbin Code was managing this share of it, and then this share of it managed 80. Then suddenly the railways kicked in, and the railways were getting all this share of it, and they were doing nothing. So they suddenly had to think, oh my God, what are we going to do? We're getting no money out of mail contracts anymore. And so, yeah,
working in distance, they had problems like that. They ended up building a railway around it. They
tended to build a railway between a place called Birmingham and Tedderfield, which is part of the Great Northern Line, I think. Part of Australia, on top of the Great Dividing Range, and that's rocky, hard, granite country. And they had no idea what to do with a railway. They employed people from navvies to come and do the blasting for them, and these guys on strike, and then all the wood rotted, and then they all got infectious diseases, and then a month behind schedule, they ended up losing a fortune on the contract, and it was a disaster for them. And it made me realise you should never go into businesses you haven't done before, because they thought everyone was doing railways, and they should too, but it was a mess. Anyway, so they were in a mess too by the early 90s, and everyone in the country was in a mess. You know why the rats on there? Because at the time there was a rabbit plague in Australia. We had an enormous rabbit plague through much of past Australia, and people, before we were able to introduce that myxomatosis thing, and so lots of farmers were finding their crops just eaten by rabbits. That was one of the problems for the squatters, including Cobbin Code had all these stations of their own. What Queensland is a good story about. Queensland, this is the total miles of routes the Cobbin Code ran in Queensland from 1886 when they started to 1923 when they finished. And they peaked in the number of routes in 1900. They had about 4,500 miles of routes in Queensland. So they were just peaking when Victoria's routes were gone. Because Queensland, of course, is a huge state and had not a railway network like we have here, and neither sort of, coaches, so they didn't have all the rail they had down here. Of course, we talked about that already, the fact she built the grand house for the kids when Harry died and went to war with James Wellison. She became very powerful, and she's sitting here in her front garden with a man on the far left, his name was Edmund Barton, Australia's first Prime Minister. And he was a great friend of her daughter, Katie, and they were invited to his sort of opening palms down here in Melbourne in 1901 as his guests. So they were well connected, powerful family back then, and had all the right people to stay, as you did. What Bella did, she had lots of money, she bought a motor car in 1904 or 5, one of the first people in the area of this side. Motor cars were just coming into play. Of course, as a woman she wouldn't drive, she was a chauffeur. She was a chauffeur driver back and forth to Sydney and over to her friends and so forth. Cobbin Code though wasn't into cars, and they didn't see her riding on the wall and decided, oh, they're not going to go into cars, we'll stay with horses. Bella upgraded to a smarter car, which was all worse, in a few years' time. But still Cobbin Code decided, well, we're not going to go into motor vehicles. They called them motorbikes, okay? It's the official one, okay? This is Cobbin Code's coach factory in Charleville, disturbed the hour about 9:13 and they had to rebuild it again. They thought they would keep building coaches, we don't know anything about cars. What happened was that World War One occurred, and once the troops came back after that in 1918, was it? The front said to Clark after the war. All the term soldiers had up to no work, and they needed work, and the government found they can give the jobs to them, drive trucks to deliver the mail, much cheaper than they can afford a common car to do the same thing with 50 horses and a driver. So suddenly all these return servants were winning the post contracts that common car used to have, or mail contracts. So it was a bit of a goodbye to them. These are the kind of vehicles they'd use. These are the service for these books with a flatbed sort of wagon, like that. And Cobble Coast suddenly invested in a few at the last minute. They decided they'd buy a few and load up people's fabrics inside. There wasn't much room, but you could still put 6 people in. If you had a big sun hat on, you wouldn't get too burnt. Or you'd sit on a sort of flatbed truck like that and load things up on it that way. And these stopped packing about 1916, 1920. And they even started stocking their motor buggies in their showrooms for people to buy if you wanted to manage to import those from overseas. So it was all a bit too little and too late, and suddenly they had a ton of unemployed drivers. They had a whole lot of stores for that stage of the country in Australia, and they decided to put these unemployed drivers behind the counter selling stuff. But the drivers were instrumental and hated them indoors. They were used to being outdoor chappies for yarns, and they got a bit heartbroken about all this. So it was a bit sad for the drivers. And of course, what was happening there at the same time, Cobbing Club was closing up in 1923, a little company called Queensland Northern Chevrolet, also the Sustainable in Melbourne, about the Longreach, where Cobbing Club's last works were closing. And so, of course, that was sort of the last bastion. Suddenly the white plane was taken over from what Cobbing Club was doing in the outback, and they had to stop. I hope that's given you a good background in the book. Yeah. So about that leisure, the book, and it did so well, the team did a second edition in the last year, maybe? So it was a topic for me. The one thing we didn't talk about much today is the personal story behind James Glasser, because he was an expressive, and he struggled for years with that, and hiding that illness from family and society, and it wasn't until I uncovered it from hospital records in the farm. I found his suicide attempts and what had happened there. The incredible thing about him though is he was very bothered on his business. While he did sort of have these episodes, and once he had a complicity episode, they locked him away and put him on steamer off to America for 2 months, where he could recover and get back his sort of his health, cheer up after a few months of just rest and recuperation. And he was able to come back and, be mad again. And in that sense, there's a fellow from Mary Ripley you might have heard of. He's got a lot of depression as well.
Yeah.
And he sort of did see him lots of successful business coming over the years.
Teachers,
yeah, people who just sort of, have huge energy and then other times they're just really depressed.
Yeah.
And it was hard for me because the families, the relatives, defendants had wanted the book to be written because I hadn't wanted their dirty laundry. Well, they wouldn't have to the family to be close. So there's still a stigma attached to mental laws in the country. Yeah, that's awful. So that was a harder thing for them to come to terms with.
Why did they agree to it?
Well, it's just. They refused access to a lot of the material in the library that they'd kept in their private letters and so forth, but there were other sources I was lucky enough to find. It wasn't as if Joan Clark was still alive in the private issues. We're talking about 100 years ago. Yeah.
They've been
inside
war instruments.
Yeah, when you're writing a book, publishers ask you to source your own photos to go in the book. I went around a whole lot of museum collections around Australia, and libraries, and old books, and people's attics. And over the years, we've got a whole set of photos, some of which are in the book, some of which aren't.
And I had it, so I thought, what can you do with these? So I thought, I'm not doing it at all. And so that's how this all came. So that was by those. The publisher's what he paid for about, I don't know, 25 or 30 books. And so, and the society just sort of appreciated it. It just was, there's always a, if anybody is a keen reader, there's a few copies of the book I bought. Okay, so far away, if you do want to buy one, if you're a reader, but I'm sure you can get it on live as well. If you're more interested, if you want to know sort of more detail. Yeah. Did anyone else have a question?
Well, no, it lives on. You see it on the side of buses now.
Yeah, that's right. What happened is, after Coventry sold out in 1923, for the liquidation, a guy called Gordon Studd bought the business and bought the brand name and started the bus line up as Woolman. And there's still a bus ride that's probably operating around the country this way. Yeah. And apparently a restaurant chain in New Zealand.
This is Niagara.
Right.
I'm in the Rumble Coffee.
New Zealand.
A restaurant my family always went
to. There you go. Yeah. I've heard that a lot. What's the little, you know, what's the comment on that one?
When I was about 5 years old, I think you had
a company there. Yeah. So it became a big coach company in New Zealand, run by 7 people in New Zealand. But it was a very well known name of the bookstore for it. People were always interested in the history of it. So, and it's funny, when we had all the droughts down here in Victoria, back in the 1850s, they couldn't get hay, they shipped hay over from New Zealand to feed the horses. Because, you know, it's quite unfortunate for them, but they had to do it because, you know, there was no hay here to feed all the Australians. If you're running a big catch line, you've got hundreds of horses, you need hay. Does anyone else have any questions? Well, I suppose if I put my shoulders on this properly, and I was playing with these old chairs, the silver that I had to cover the property when I was in Africa, and I wondered why they were there, and why my godfather had a little purpose in his